dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In a May 17th article, news anchor Dan Rather finally came clean about the media manipulation surrounding the Bush administration's war on the world. Unfortunately, his confession came not in the pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post, where it might be seen by many Americans. The article, titled U.S. Media Cowed by Patriotic Fever, Says CBS Star, was written by Matthew Engel for the British newspaper The Guardian and based on an interview on British television. Engel wrote, Dan Rather, the star news anchor for the U.S. television network CBS, said last night that, quote, patriotism run amok, unquote, was in danger of trampling the freedom of American journalists to ask tough questions. And he admitted that he had shrunk from taking on the Bush administration over the war on terrorism. In the weeks after September 11th, Rather wore a Stars and Stripes pin in his lapel during his evening news show in an apparent display of total solidarity with the American cause. However, in an interview with BBC's Newsnight, he graphically described the pressures to conform that built up after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Quote, it's an obscene comparison. You know, I'm not sure I like it. But you know, there was a time in South Africa that people would put flaming tires around people's necks if they dissented. And in some ways, the fear is that you will be necklaced here. You will have a flaming tire of lack of patriotism around your neck, he said. Now it is that fear that keeps journalists from asking the toughest of the tough questions. Rather did not exempt himself from the criticism and said the problem was self-censorship. Quote, it starts with a feeling of patriotism within oneself. It carries through with a certain knowledge that the country as a whole, and for all the right reasons, felt and continues to feel this surge of patriotism within themselves. And one finds oneself saying, I know the right question, but you know what? This is not exactly the right time to ask it. Such a confession is astonishing, bearing in mind its source. Rather is almost as famous in the U.S. as the president, though he is more secure in his tenure, far better paid, and probably more pampered. Rather, 70, has held what used to be regarded as the top job in American journalism for two decades, since he was chosen to succeed the revered and avuncular Walter Cronkite as CBS News anchorman. Traditionally, CBS was the country's number one news channel, but has lost its status and ratings after years of budget cutbacks. The White House was to blame for its failure to provide adequate information about the war, Rather said. Quote, there has never been an American war, small or large, in which access has been so limited as this one. Limiting access, limiting information to cover the backsides of those who are in charge of the war is extremely dangerous and cannot and should not be accepted. And I am sorry to say that, up to and including the moment of this interview, that overwhelmingly it has been accepted by the American people. And the current administration revels in that, they relish that, and they take refuge in that, close quote. He said his view of patriotism differed from that of the administration. Quote, it's unpatriotic not to stand up, to look them in the eye, and ask the questions they don't want to hear, they being those who have the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility, of sending our sons and daughters, our husbands, wives, our blood, to face death. Close quote. At least as quoted in this article, Rather falls short of stating the obvious. that the acceptance by the American people of the lies and obfuscation can be laid at the feet of Rather and the corporate-controlled media of which he is a part, as it was they who distributed government lies, propaganda, and obfuscation, as if these were the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. If Rather and his colleagues voiced doubts and asked tough questions, public confidence and support for government action would change. And the people controlling the American media know that, as our speakers tonight will show. Our speakers tonight are all members of what our first speaker, reporter Jeremy Scahill, calls rebel media, those free voices outside the control of the puppeteers who pull Dan Rather's strings, and not only in terms of the war on terrorism. We'll look at the depth of self-censorship and censorship from above, and at corporate media and government collaboration in this limiting of news and information to the American public, and its impact on society through the eyes of several people on the front lines of the fight for a real free press in America.
I first came to know Jeremy a number of years ago when he was living in the Catholic Worker House in New York and was traveling around with the Berrigans. Since then, I've had the pleasure of working with him as he has covered some of the U.S.-sponsored wars around the globe the last several years, including the U.S. bombing of Iraq in 1998, the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, and most recently he's been covering Afghanistan remotely for Free Speech Radio News. Very pleased to have Jeremy Scahill with us tonight, and we'll have a presentation and then time for question and answer after that.
What has our president told us, dear president told us over the last couple of months? He said, we're going to smoke them out. We're going to get them running. We're going to hunt them down. We're going to chase them out of their holes. We're going to get the folks who did this. Freedom was attacked and freedom will be defended. And then in his classic capturing of the English language, Mr. Bush said, they've misunderestimated me and they've misunderestimated America. Among the goals of the Bush administration in this lovely so-called war on terror was bin Laden wanted dead or alive, and Mullah Omar wanted dead or alive. Now, both of those guys are still nowhere to be seen, nowhere to be found whatsoever. In fact, did you guys see those ridiculous composite sketches they have now of Osama bin Laden, like the one where he has the Yankees cap on, and you know, I think he has an FDNY t-shirt on in one of them, too. So they have they're generating these ridiculous sketches of bin Laden and all these stories about where he could possibly be. So we haven't achieved that goal. We, meaning the Bush administration, pardon my attachment of myself to the Bush administration, like so much of the media do these days. But then a lesser known goal of this was articulated by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who really appears as sort of a Nazi doctor. At those press conferences, you know, he gets praised on Fox News for how clever he is and how he handles the press and explains to them, you can do this, you can't do that. But this is really an extraordinary statement to be made by a Secretary of Defense, and it should go down in the history of absolutely shocking remarks from U.S. officials. Rumsfeld was asked in the first several days after September 11th, how are you going to define victory in this war on terror? And Rumsfeld always had a different answer for it, generally about how we're going to wipe out terrorism around the world. And then when things didn't start to go so well, then it was, you know, we want to get rid of the Taliban and we want to force Al-Qaeda. And he started sounding like Bush. But one day he said, victory is creating a world with powerful weapons and powerful people not afraid to use them. Think about it. It's an extraordinary statement. What on earth does that have to do with this so-called war on terror? It slipped past so many people. It wasn't quoted the next day in the newspapers. It wasn't the clip that was taken from TV. It was part of the live press conference, and I think it was said and it was gone in sort of a moment. But again, victory is creating a world with powerful weapons and powerful people not afraid to use them. And if you think about it, that's exactly what this so-called war on terror is about. It's not about the Taliban. It's not about Osama bin Laden or Bush's father's friends from the Mujahideen. This is about resurrecting everything that those guys loved from the Cold War, throwing in the Gulf War, throwing in Somalia, throwing in every filthy, dirty U.S. intervention that's happened in the past 50 years, and making it all one. The defense contractors are loving this. There's unprecedented unity in the Congress. Only Russ Feingold voted against the anti-terrorism bill. Only Barbara Lee voted against the bombing of Afghanistan. And so we have this tremendous unity, they say. United we stand. And so they're not achieving any of the goals that they've stated to the American people, but they're doing a damn good job of resurrecting the Cold War and adding to it overt military action and covert military action. Dick Cheney, from his bunker somewhere, is running this dirty war. And he said, we need to put unsavory people back on the CIA payroll. Well, I doubt that they'd ever be taken off, or have been taken off. But the fact that Dick Cheney is now saying this openly, these are things that we've seen before in American history. Nothing is new about what Bush is doing right now. There's absolutely nothing. They say this is a different kind of war. This isn't different from anything. This is the war that the United States has been waging for decades. Some would say for more than a century. So they haven't achieved any of the goals that they've stated to the American people, but what they have achieved is slaughtering more innocent civilians than were killed in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I'm sure I don't have to tell people in this room about the report that was done by Professor Mark Harold of the University of New Hampshire. What he did was he went through all mainstream media accounts and some regional media accounts, and he cross-referenced the number of civilians who were reportedly killed, according to the media, in various days of bombing since October 7th. And as of 2 weeks ago, he put the toll at more than 3,700. You can find his report online, but he explains the methodology that he used for coming up with that number and cross-referencing things a number of times and making sure that the numbers were solid according to established press reports. So they've now killed more than 3,700 civilians to avenge the deaths of approximately the same number of people. I remembered what Dave Dellinger, the great legendary activist, said, or actually wrote, when the United States dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he talked about the way in which that act, the immediate incineration of hundreds of thousands of people, wiped out any allegiance that any American owes to this government. And right now we're being told by the Attorney General John Ashcroft that to criticize his policies is to side with the terrorists. George Bush is saying either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. You're with us or against us. And I think these are times that beg us to be courageous people. And we have to say clearly that to be a patriot in America today under these circumstances is to be a dissident. No one is going to come and knock on any of our doors and say, now is the time in your life when you need to stand up and scream out no. No one's going to come and knock on your door and say, now is the time to stand up for the voiceless people of Afghanistan who have been terrorized by U.S. bombs. No one is going to stand up and say to you, now is the time for you to speak out against the slaughter of Iraqi civilians. That's something that needs to come from community groups like this. It needs to be a bottom-up thing. It starts with the small vigils. It starts with the publications. It starts with community radio like WORT. But no one's going to knock on your door and say, hey, this is the movement of your lifetime. This is the movement that you have to be a part of. And that's one of the problems with the left in America today, is we're all waiting for that knock on the door, and it's not going to come. It has to come from within us. And it's shocking to see the lack of dissent right now in America across the board. My family lives in Milwaukee, and one of their neighbors came and knocked on the door and asked them why they don't have a flag up. They're like, it's some kind of neighborhood requirement or something. I was telling my mom she should put up a white flag. And another extraordinary thing about this bombing is the testing of their toys and their equipment, these daisy cutter bombs. They brag about it being the most powerful bomb short of a nuclear bomb. These are 15,000-pound munitions. Imagine 15,000-pound. They're the size of like one of those old Volkswagen Beetles. And they can't even be dropped from a plane. They have to be pushed out the back of a plane by Marines. And then they descend with a parachute, and they have a 3-foot probe that sticks out on them. And when the probe hits the ground, they suck up everything within a 600-yard radius. It's gone. It's completely gone. And they leave an enormous crater in the ground. And the United States was using those when they were talking about the carpet bombing in Mazar-e-Sharif in the north of Afghanistan. That's what they were using. And these things implode and suck everything into the center. They completely wipe out all life within a 600-yard radius. And they were using these things regularly. And the cluster bombs. I have experience with what cluster bombs can do to people from Yugoslavia, where the United States was widely using them. These are one of the most horrifying munitions in the U.S. arsenal. But the cluster bombs drop from an airplane, and they look like a little canister. And when they're making their descent, and they break up into smaller canisters, and they spread out over the radius of 7 football fields. And then right before they hit the ground, they shred into tiny pieces of shrapnel. They turn everything in its path into shredded beef. These were used on human beings directly in both in Iraq, in Yugoslavia, and now in Afghanistan. In fact, there are still villagers in remote parts of Afghanistan who are surrounded. Their villages are surrounded by cluster bombs, and they're facing starvation because they can't get out of their homes, because they're surrounded by them. And they're very colorful. They're yellow. And so many are the stories of children going up and touching a cluster bomb because it's something colorful. There's something appealing about them. And one can't help but wonder, is it intentional that they make them that color? And you could say, well, that's very cynical, but the very use of these weapons is cynical. And to add to all of that cynicism, then they mistakenly made their snack packets that they were dropping on Afghanistan the identical color to the cluster bombs. So the poor, desperate people living in a repressive regime, being bombed by another repressive regime, are running out to get their peanut butter sandwich and ketchup that the U.S. has generously donated to them. And several people were killed in that manner, and several children were killed. It was reported widely in the European press, and it wasn't making the newspapers here. These cluster bombs are absolutely devastating, and like a nuclear bomb, they continue to kill after they're dropped. It's not just an immediate impact. It kills the people in the vicinity. They continue to kill. The United States has also recently confirmed that it's using depleted uranium munitions in Afghanistan. I spent a lot of time in the south of Iraq, in Basra, where the rates of childhood leukemia and basic cancers have risen 1/3 since the Gulf War. I remember sitting in a hospital in Basra with a woman whose husband was an Iraqi veteran and who lived in Basra, and it was the first time that she had been in a hospital, and she was 8 months pregnant. And they did an ultrasound on her, and they discovered that that her child had no brain while we were sitting with her. They discovered that her child had no brain. And that her baby she was going to have to go through the process of labor, and her child would die. And it was a direct result of the fact that her husband and she were both exposed to tremendous amounts of depleted uranium munitions, highly radioactive. And it's not just the munitions of depleted uranium that they're using. They're firing off tens of thousands of rounds of these radioactive coated bullets. But they're also using the depleted uranium as a balancing mechanism in their missiles because they're heavier and they create a bigger impact. And so the United States is again using these in Afghanistan, and they use them in Yugoslavia. They fired off more than 30,000 rounds of depleted uranium in Kosovo. So now people in Kosovo, in the south of Serbia, are living in an essentially polluted environment. And outside of Kosovo, in parts of eastern Serbia, that's the same case, and there's been documentation by Yugoslav scientists already on increases in cancer rates among people who were exposed to the depleted uranium. So this cycle is not only continuing, it's being escalated. And as the Bush administration now looks to the next target, perhaps Iraq, perhaps Somalia, perhaps the Sudan, perhaps Yemen, perhaps the world, this is a man who was not elected president who's declared war on the world. The kinds of weapons that are being used right now need to be resisted as deeply as the age of the advent of the nuclear bomb. The nuclear bomb, of course, needs to be resisted, but the nature of these weapons are so insidious right now that they're using. We all need to pay attention to the details of the kinds of weapons that are found in the U.S. arsenal. I want to talk for a few minutes about what I was asked to speak about, and then I want to go back to talking about this so-called war on terror. Thomas Friedman, who was the great foreign policy writer of the New York Times. He's there. He's the man. When the bombing of Yugoslavia started, Thomas Friedman wrote a column in which he pointed out that Slobodan Milosevic was democratically elected. What's Thomas Friedman doing saying something like that when the U.S. is attacking? I mean, the U.S. is attacking a democratically elected government, Mr. Friedman? And he said, that Slobodan Milosevic was democratically elected, and therefore it's not just about him and his regime and his paramilitaries and his killers and his ethnic cleansers. It's also about the Serbian people, because they elected him. This is not a war against Slobodan Milosevic. All of the Serbs need to be bottled up, so Thomas Friedman said. And he said, every day you ravage Kosovo is another century that we are going to set your country back. You want 1859, we can do 1859. You want 1389, we can do that too. Thomas Friedman from the New York Times. And so today, the entire media are like Thomas Friedman. We have the Fox News Channel where they're talking about the one-eyed Cyclops, Mullah Muhammad Omar, Bin Laden with the diaper on his head, Dan Rather appearing just a couple of days after September 11th, saying that George Bush is the commander-in-chief, he just needs to say the word and I'm there. This is the anchor of one of the major newscasts in this country. And of course, this room isn't shocked by that kind of a statement. The American people were assured by it. They felt, you know, Dan Rather's one of us. Geraldo Rivera, the war correspondent for Fox News, someone tell me what war he covered, and I'd like to see the coverage. He spent the entire Yugoslavia war in northern Albania, having never stepped foot inside of Kosovo during the war at all. Before he left to go cover the Afghanistan war, he was interviewed on Fox News, and he said, you know, in all the wars I've covered, I've come to realize one thing, that there are just some conflicts where there's only one side to it. And this is one of those conflicts. We have to support our freedom fighters from the Northern Alliance. Geraldo must not have read Human Rights Watch report on General Rashid Dostum, documenting how in 1998 he killed 2,000 innocent civilians in Afghanistan. These are the crooks, the killers that we've now backed and put into power in Afghanistan. So Geraldo's off with his buddies from the Northern Alliance. And what's interesting is Geraldo paid something in the ballpark of $20,000 to $30,000. I don't recall the exact figure, but it's been documented in the press. $20,000 to $30,000 to a gang of armed thugs to get him into Afghanistan. And now think about this. So we see this footage of overjoyed Afghans, happy to see Geraldo, happy to see the U.S. forces, happy to see the Taliban gone, happy to see the Northern Alliance coming into town. And it appears as though, wow, this was a tremendous success. We've liberated yet another people. But I've been on the ground in situations where you capture this kind of footage as a TV journalist. And what you're not seeing on that camera is that this group of villagers over here appears to be speaking with Geraldo Rivera or the guy from ABC or NBC or Seymour BS or whichever network happens to be doing it. And so it appears as though this journalist is doing a heart-wrenching interview with these people talking about the repression of the Taliban and how glad they are to see the Northern Alliance. That's the main point, really, is how glad they are to see U.S. forces in the Northern Alliance. Not so much about the Taliban, who are now referred to as the Arabs. So what you don't see is the gang of thugs behind Geraldo Rivera that are protecting him, that are from the Northern Alliance, that are staring at these villagers. If I were those villagers, even if I love the Taliban, if my husband was Mullah Muhammad Omar, I'm going to say I love the Northern Alliance. You have this gang of thugs. It was a classic scenario in Kosovo. KLA, Kosovo Liberation Army, thugs were hired by CNN and Fox and ABC and CBS to go around and conduct interviews. They were translators. These guys were the other day killing Serbian police officers and torching Serbian villages and harassing and murdering Albanians who didn't side with them, and the next day they're serving as a translator for CNN. You think villagers are going to say to these people, we're scared of the KLA? No, we support the KLA. And that's the side, I mean, when you're on the ground in those situations, you see extraordinary intellectual dishonesty on the part of journalists. Inherent to hiring armed, murderous thugs from the Northern Alliance is you're going to get a great story about how great the Northern Alliance is, and that's what we're seeing a lot of on TV. And so you have to keep all of those kinds of things in perspective. How was this information gathered when you see interviews with people hailing the arrival of U.S. forces? And there's all this discussion about the burqa. The women of Afghanistan are going to throw off the burqa, and they're overjoyed to throw off the burqa. And that was the favorite. And the Fox correspondent, Steve Harrigan's running around. He's got a burqa on, and he's life behind the burqa with Steve Harrigan. It was a special one night on Fox. And he puts it over the camera, and he's walking around. This is what the women see in Kabul. And they're talking. And okay, I don't really have a political opinion about the burqa. I don't think anybody should be forced to wear anything in any society, whether you're a woman or a man or a child. But if someone chooses to wear that, either for religious reasons or for cultural reasons, it's not for America to say, oh, that's repressive that the women are wearing that. If anyone's forced to do it, of course it is. But let me tell you what I think the greatest act of repression, short of killing and whipping people in Afghanistan has been, was when the U.S. military flew in the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders to do a strip show for American forces in Kandahar. And did people see this? Unbelievable. It's these drooling American forces with their video cams grabbing, wanting to put a dollar in the woman. I mean, they're doing this. They're doing this inside of an Islamic country. I mean, it was unreal to watch this. I forget who it was, but Mariah Carey just performed at Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, did her little strip show too. And it's, we're talking about the repression of women in Afghanistan, and there certainly are tremendous issues there. But look at what U.S. forces are doing as well, the liberators, the freedom lovers, the Democrats. There was an interest during the bombing in Yugoslavia. There was an extraordinary scene at the Hyatt Hotel. The Hyatt Hotel is this like epic building in Belgrade, and it's where all the journalists come, and it was anywhere between $150 to $250 a night for journalists to stay there. And it was the only place in Belgrade that was pretty much guaranteed to have electricity 24/7. Hospitals, when NATO would drop these graphite bombs, which spread out over an electrical system, and they essentially shut it down, and a tiny little part of this, it's like a hair, if you drop that into your hard drive of your computer, it's gone. It's not going to work anymore. So they were draping these things over the electrical supplies in Belgrade. It looked like moss sort of hanging down over it, and it would wipe out the electricity sometimes for several days or weeks. And Belgrade is still on a very, in some parts of the city, on a very old-fashioned system where if part of it is knocked down, that's it. That is the source of electricity. No power generator, no backup supply, none of that. So they were dropping these graphite bombs all around Belgrade. And on several occasions, they dropped it over electrical supplies, which were needed by hospitals. And when you cut out the electricity in a hospital with premature babies in incubators, it's minutes that those children have in those incubators. And several children died in those incubators. And my wife was working as a translator for foreign journalists during the bombing. She's from Yugoslavia and was working as a translator and fixer. And she was in a hospital one night, and this happened, and a woman's child died. And the journalists are saying to her, go up and ask her how she feels. Go ask her what she's thinking about right now. Her daughter has just died. Go up and ask her how does she feel. I visited a neighborhood one time in Belgrade, and outside of Belgrade, after it had been very heavily bombed with cruise missiles. And we had heard that it had been hit. We went out there. The missiles were still smoking. And we walked up the road, and we came across this beautiful house that had artists built this house written all over it. It was gorgeous, and it had a very big sort of open window space, a huge open window space in one part of it that had been completely smashed. And it was about as tall as this ceiling. It was a very high ceiling on the first floor. And when you got a little bit closer, you saw that there was pottery and sculpture and paintings. Beautiful, that had all been smashed by this cruise missile. And we approached the house, and it's a young couple that's living there, and they're artists. And they're digging through the rubble of their house. And they probably had saved up generations to build this place. It was like their dream. And we walk in, and they agree to sort of show us around their house, and they spoke English, and they were, sharing with us. They had just lost their house and their life's work. And they're sharing with us how they felt. And this other journalist from a big newspaper in London comes in, and he says to them, not hello, not hi, I'm so-and-so, not do you mind if I ask you some questions? So what happened here? shrapnel had gone through their son's pillow directly, and just by some grace, they had happened to have taken their kids to the basement that night when they heard the roar of the planes. But I remember standing in this kid's bedroom, his toys scattered everywhere, the window broken, and shrapnel through the center of the pillow. If their son was sleeping in that bed, he would have been killed. And the callousness, it's the culture that we grow up in that permits journalists to only see this as the story and not as the people. Asking Ivana, ask her what she feels like, ask her what she's thinking, what happened here? These stories are replicated 1,000 times over in every single conflict. And it's most oftentimes the journalists from the United States and Britain who are conducting themselves in this manner. People who are from countries that have felt the scourge of war or U.S.-sponsored war don't ask those kinds of questions when they walk into a house where it's just been destroyed by cruise missiles. So back to the Hyatt Hotel in Belgrade. You can get any food you want at the Hyatt Hotel in Belgrade during the bombing. You know, you got people waiting in hours in line for oil and sugar, if it's even around, bread, any basic food. You know, people are living, big parts of the country are living in absolute darkness. These people are living like, you know, kings. I want a Caesar salad today. How about a hamburger? You know, I feel like Taco Bell tonight. You know, anything you want is in there. And they're getting their massages from the, you know, from the Serbs who are being bombed. And, you know, there's the New York Times is feeling good. The back's all loosened up now. I can go back to the hot tub. And, you know, you can get a manicure, a pedicure, all these things in the Hyatt. Meanwhile, the kids are dying in the incubators. They're hanging out in the Hyatt. Send their translator out to gather a few quotes from some people. I mean, it was considered like a luxurious assignment to go there and hang out at the Hyatt and hire a couple Serbs to go out and do some interviews. And so anyway, there was an article by a reporter named John Simpson from the BBC that appeared in the Sunday Telegraph in Britain. And Simpson's writing on how he had suffered an injury during the bombing. And he wrote this up in the newspaper. It was a big deal. Just, you know, Simpson inside of Serbia's hospitals, you know, during the bombing, the Serb hospital. And so, you know, one would read it and think, you know, was it one of Milosevic's guys who did something to John when he was hunting down the story? Or was it a right-wing paramilitary in the country that had sort of cornered him and he miraculously got out? You never find out in the article. Well, it turns out that good old John had one too many drinks in the hot tub at the Hyatt, and getting out of it, slipped and sprained his ankle. And that's how he ended up in the hospital. So this is, you know, it's war injury. And at the Hyatt Hotel, it's like, you know, it's like this frat boy scene. You know, they're all hanging out, and they're laughing it up and yucking it up and having a grand old time. You know, the country's being bombed. And you know, hey, buddy, you know, you paid for these bombs. How can you be sitting in this hotel getting your back rubbed by these people? I mean, there's no conscience whatsoever on the part of so many of these guys. I mean, you do have some extraordinary journalists. Paul Watson from the LA Times was fantastic. Robert Fisk, who's regularly on WORT, who very nearly got killed in Pakistan. But again, there's a Hyatt Hotel in most of these conflict zones. I'm sure one's sprouted out right now in Kabul, where they're all staying. I like Baghdad's response, though, to the journalist hotel, the Al Rashid. Has this mosaic, a huge mosaic when you walk into the hotel, and it's Bush's father's face, it's Bush the elder, on the thing, and it says Bush is a war criminal. And so in order to go into the hotel, you have to step on Bush's face to get in. So that was sort of, but actually the place where that, I mean, this is very serious, so the place where Bush's face is on the floor there in mosaic was also the place where two workers from that hotel were killed by U.S. bombs. And that's why Bush is a war criminal is placed in that particular place. You know, and talking about covering U.S.-sponsored wars, I mean, I think it's also important to look at the way that the United States has targeted media. You know, we talk about, you know, Milosevic was, you know, restricting press freedoms in Yugoslavia, and absolutely he was. And, you know, no free press in Iraq, I mean, not even a TV in Kabul, which isn't that bad of a thing. But you know, the United States did something that was really unprecedented in the Yugoslavia bombing. They put on the target list Radio Television Serbia. They actually listed it as a target to be bombed, and then they bombed Radio Television Serbia and killed 16 of the workers there. Now, these weren't Milosevic's celebrity journalists. These weren't the, you know, I mean, we can name off who those people are, but not a single one of them was in the building that night. Not a single one of Milosevic's chief propagandists were in the building that night. The people who worked the third shift are not the celebrities. The people that were in that building, the overwhelming majority of them were makeup artists, technicians, engineers that were killed in that bombing. And they tried to sue the United States. They tried to bring charges against the U.S. at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, and that was rejected by Carla Del Ponte, the chief war crimes prosecutor. She said that the U.S. committed no war crimes. Human Rights Wing Watch said that that was not a war crime, the bombing of Radio Television Serbia. Their case was the families now tried to sue NATO in the European Court of Human Rights, and they threw it out. Established power in the world refuses to recognize the killing of those 16 journalists as a war crime or a crime of any nature. And in the most recent bombing of the United States, the bombing of Afghanistan, they also bombed Al Jazeera television, their offices. And thank God no one from Al Jazeera was in the building. But they bombed Al Jazeera intentionally because Al Jazeera was the only media outlet that was actually providing footage of what was on the other side of the barrel of the gun. We see this side of the barrel of the gun, but we don't see this side. Most of the world looks up at the gun. We look down at them from our cameras. Our guns from the United States and our cameras are pointed this way, and everyone else is looking that way, and that's what Al Jazeera was doing. They also bombed the Associated Press, you know, which is generally you know, an outlet for Colin Powell's latest press release, and they bombed the BBC. In fact, the BBC correspondent was on live when their office got hit on camera. He was on a video phone, and you just see it just smashes in, and the room explodes. You know, and he and his people run for cover, and you know, but the U.S. was targeting journalists. And you know, it's interesting, when Radio Television Serbia was bombed, myself and a couple of other journalists and people from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting contacted the Committee to Protect Journalists because their annual report for 1999 had come out, and there was no listing of the 16 journalists of Radio Television Serbia had been killed. And so, you know, we made a couple of innocent calls. You must have left this out. You must have forgotten it. You know, these 16 journalists were killed. You know, anyone who's killed by like a death squad somewhere is going to be on that list, as they should be. But anyone who's killed by U.S. No, that was a legitimate target. In fact, that's what the Committee to Protect Journalists told us. That was a legitimate target. Those weren't journalists, they were propagandists. And let me tell you something. You know who the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists is? A woman named Kaidi Martin. You know who she is? Richard Holbrooke's wife. Richard Holbrooke was the trigger man on the bombing of Yugoslavia. He's probably the guy who said, let's hit Radio Television Serbia. You know, so his wife is the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and she's the one saying, in her defense of journalists around the world, that these weren't journalists, they were propagandists. What is Fox News today? What is CNN, NBC, CBS, ABC? We have folks. We have state media in this country, and the thing is that because there's no line drawn by the American people between the corporations and the government, it's state media. These people are on the same team, just like Milosevic and his media cronies are on the same team. This is state media, but we don't think of it in that way. CNN's just much more sophisticated. They speed up the tapes for the Pentagon so that it makes it look like, oh, when we bombed that train, it was just that the pilot couldn't get his, you know, the trigger moved fast enough, and so we directly hit the train, and we decapitated a Serbian Orthodox priest in that bombing, and whoops! You know, that's state media. And it's patriotic media. You know, we bounce from the State Department to the Pentagon to the White House to check out what Ari Fleischer is going to say. And then we go back to the Pentagon, and let's talk to some retired generals, and then a retired admiral, and then this special ops guy, and that's what's on TV all day long. And that's what's in the papers the next day all day long. And that's how it goes. And there's no, you know, there's no examination whatsoever of the causes behind what happened on September 11th. You know, I remember watching, he's a very right-wing, generally bad reporter, this guy T.R. Reid for the Washington Post, he writes out of Europe. And he was being interviewed on Christiane Amanpour's new show on CNN International, something called, like, you know, war correspondent, like they all are now. And T.R. Reid was saying, you know, I've been trying to do a story about looking at why the rest of the world hates America so much, but my editors aren't really, they said it's too hot. You know, and I'm sure that this guy's peace was going to have nothing to do with the sanctions against Iraq or the, you know, Israeli slaughtering of the Palestinians with U.S. weapons or, you know, God forbid East Timor and the history of the U.S. could be mentioned with that. I mean, it's probably something about how, this is the classic line, they hate us because we have two cars and McDonald's and shopping malls. You know, the Wall Street Journal did a poll shortly after September 11th of what they called moneyed Arabs, businessmen, lawyers, stockbrokers in Muslim countries in the Middle East who have close business ties to the United States. And 70% of these guys said that they despised America because of its policy in Iraq and its support for Israel. And these are moneyed Arabs. These are cronies of people in Washington. And so if that's their perspective as to why the United States is hated so much or why they despise the American government, largely people around the world don't hate Americans. But they live on the other side of the barrel of that gun, and they have very good reason to be against what the United States is doing to them. I mean, imagine what the sentiments are on Main Street, but it's still portrayed in the American press because we have our McDonald's, they're jealous of us, and so they blow up the World Trade Center. So the corporate media in this country and around the world, they are whitewashing the extent to which America is responsible for Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in the way that I just said, in the sense of we don't want to examine what was behind September 11th, but also in not telling the story of the extraordinary U.S. support for the Islamic fundamentalists. There is an unbelievable new book out that has not been published in America yet. It was written by two French journalists, and one of them was a former member of the French secret police, and the other was one of the top investigative journalists in France. And the book is called "Bin Laden: The Forbidden Truth," and it should be out sometime by the end of February. You know, a lot of people, I'm sure, in this room have been doing a lot of research, and I saw Alan's article in the No War Times about the oil connection in Afghanistan, and I think it's something that a lot of us are, of course, examining and paying attention to, and trying to, as always, figure out what's the real motive behind this. And in Afghanistan, I mean, it's pretty clear because it goes back for decades, and a lot of people are familiar with the pipeline. But with the Bush administration in power, it takes on a new dimension: the oligarchy. You know, Vice President Dick Cheney, of course, was the president of Halliburton, which is one of the largest companies in the world that provides services for the oil industry. They're also getting contracts secretly in Iraq to do construction, and now they're one of the top investors itching to get into Serbia to do reconstruction as well, now that NATO did $60 billion worth of damage. Then you have the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. She was a director for Chevron at the time when Amy Goodman and myself documented the killing of two Nigerian activists with the direct participation of the Chevron Oil Corporation in the Niger Delta in Nigeria, people who were protesting against Chevron's massacring of their environment and their land. People occupied a barge in this remote village in the Niger Delta to protest. And Chevron sent in the most brutal forces of Nigeria, the mobile police, known as the kill and go, because they kill a village and they go. Sent them in on Chevron helicopters, and they opened fire on the barge of nonviolent unarmed protesters, and they wounded 30 people and they killed two others. Condoleezza Rice was a director at Chevron when that happened. And she's now the National Security Advisor, and a judge in San Francisco recently ruled that a case against Chevron for murder can go forward. And if Chevron's convicted, which they won't be, they could lose their corporate charter. So we have Dick Cheney, Halliburton, Condoleezza Rice, Chevron. Then you've got Donald Evans and Spence Abram. Both of them work for another oil giant. And also many of the officials that the U.S. now has working directly in Afghanistan have direct ties to multinational oil corporations. Hamid Karzai, the head of the interim government, was an advisor to UNICAL. As is the U.S. envoy, who is there right now, who's an Afghan-American. So you have this oligarchy, and the oligarchy is extending into Afghanistan. And this new book that just came out in France is revealing extraordinary details of the extent to which U.S. oil corporations influenced the Bush administration's policies toward Afghanistan prior to September 11th. And the main thrust of the book is that it was under the influence of these oil companies that the Bush administration blocked the FBI and CIA investigations into Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda network. And what they were hoping, there's an official quote in the book, a Bush administration official quote in the book, who said that the Taliban are seen by the Bush administration, this is prior to September 11th, as a, quote, source of stability in Central Asia that would enable the construction of a pipeline across Central Asia from the rich oil fields in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean. Now, also in this, it's extraordinary, and it's but it's not the most mind-blowing statement in the book. The authors of the book document how before the September 11th attacks, Christina Rocha, who's the head of Asian Affairs at the U.S. State Department, met with the Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Salam Zaif, in Islamabad on August 2nd. And Rocha, of course, to people who followed Afghanistan, is a veteran of U.S. involvement there. She was previously in charge of contacts with the Mujahideen and guerrilla groups at the CIA. And she oversaw the delivery of the Stinger missiles that everyone's talking about to the Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet Union. So she was meeting with him, recognizing him, legitimacy. And it also talks about how the Taliban actually hired an American public relations expert for this international image-making campaign. And what's amazing about it is that it was a woman that they hired, on the one hand. But the thing that's even more extraordinary is who she is. Her name is Layla Helms. You got two choices as to who she's related to. She's the niece of the former CIA director, Richard Helms. And Layla Helms is sort of described as the Mata Hari of U.S. Taliban relations. And she brought a top advisor to Mullah Omar to Washington in March of 2001. Like the right-hand man of Mullah Muhammad Omar to Washington in 2001, March of 2001, right after they had destroyed the ancient Buddha statues. You know. And this right-hand man of Mullah Muhammad Omar met with the Directorate of Central Intelligence at the CIA and then went on to the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department. So in March of 2001, Mullah Muhammad Omar's right-hand man is running around having chats with the CIA, with the State Department, and prior to that, they had sent a delegation to Texas to meet with UNICAL, oil executives. Business was being done with these guys. Profits were being pursued. The repression wasn't an issue. The burqas were unheard of. The Bush administration wasn't concerned about any of that. The book also documents how the deputy director of the FBI, John O'Neill, resigned in July of last year in protest of the Bush administration's blocking of their investigation of al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It's essentially telling them back off. And so he resigned in protest, and then he goes on to be head of security at the World Trade Center and was killed there on September 11th. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. And it's you know, what's really amazing is the way I heard about this is I had read a couple of reviews in sort of in Indian and Pakistani press, or as Bush calls them, the Pakis. You know, this is an extraordinary guy we have as president. And then the other day, you know, we're flipping around the tube and we see Paul Azan. Remember, you know, Paul Azan, sexy, sexy, sexy. Did you guys see those ads? There were these ads that ran on CNN last weekend, Paul Azan, and it said something like, you know, I mean, I don't watch CNN that often, even though I can talk about it, but basically they said this. What journalist is intelligent? And it shows her, like, writing something, you know. Informative, she's talking something, you know. And hard-hitting, and she's questioning, you know, one of the retired generals. And then it said, you know, and then, you know, sexy flashes on the screen, and you hear the sound of like a zipper. You know, and it's like, you know, watch Paul Azan every morning, blah, 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 on CNN. So I was watching Paul Azan, you know, this particular morning on CNN. Not for that reason, but I was just having a look. And she says, you know, we're going to talk about this explosive new book on the how the Bush administration allegedly was blocking, you know, the investigation of Al-Qaeda before September 11th. And I was like, oh my, is this CNN I'm watching? I mean, this is amazing. So then they go to these the two French authors, and they're sitting there. One's here and one's there. And Paul Azan asks them a question, and the guy begins to say essentially what I just told you. And she cuts him off and then asks another question. And the same guy answers it. And she says, okay, well, I want to thank you guys for joining us. The other guy didn't say a word. And he's just looking there stunned, like, why, what? The interview's over? The whole thing lasted about 45 seconds. And then they went on to talk then to Richard Butler, the former head of the weapons inspection program in Iraq. And then Richard Butler goes on for like 15 minutes talking about how this book is full of crap. And so that's how CNN covered this issue. The other thing is I don't know if you guys have heard of this... this company called the Carlyle Group. I don't know how many, some people probably have, but this is also an extraordinary. Noam Chomsky always says that, you know, if you really want to find out what's going on in the world, you should read the financial press. And it's remarkable how much you discover from reading the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times. But there's this magazine, it's a venture capitalist magazine called Red Herring Magazine. But redherring.com, it's an unbelievable magazine. And there was a piece in it. If you guys, if it's okay with people, if you're not getting bored with me, I can read you part of this piece, and it's unbelievable. It's called Carlyle's Way, Making a Mint Inside the Iron Triangle of Defense, Government, and Industry. It's written on January 8th. So it begins, like everyone else in the United States, the group stood transfixed as the events of September 11th unfolded. Present were former Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci, former Secretary of State James Baker, and representatives of the Bin Laden family. This was not some underground presidential bunker or Central Intelligence Agency interrogation room. It was the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C., the plush setting for the annual investor conference of one of the most powerful, well-connected, and secretive companies in the world, the Carlyle Group. And since September 11th, this little-known company has become unexpectedly important. That the Carlyle Group had its conference on America's darkest day was mere coincidence. But there is nothing accidental about the cast of characters that this private equity powerhouse has assembled in the 14 years since its founding. Among those associated with the Carlyle Group are former U.S. President George Bush, former U.K. Prime Minister John Major, and former President of the Philippines Fidel Ramos. And Carlyle has counted George Soros, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal bin Abdul Aziz Al-Saud of Saudi Arabia, and Osama bin Laden's estranged family among its high-profile clientele. The group has been able to parlay its political clout into a lucrative buyout practice, in other words, purchasing struggling companies, turning them around, and selling them for huge profits. Everything from defense contractors to telecommunications and aerospace companies. It's a kind of ruthless investing made popular by the movie Wall Street, and any industry that relies heavily on government regulation is fair game for Carlyle's brand of access capitalism. Carlyle has established itself as the gatekeeper between private business interests and U.S. defense spending. And as the Carlyle investors watched the World Trade Towers go down, the group's prospects went up. In running what its own marketing literature spookily calls a vast interlocking global network of businesses and investment professionals that operates within the so-called Iron Triangle of industry, government, and the military, the Carlyle Group leaves itself open to any number of conflicts of interest and stunning ironies. For example, it's hard to ignore the fact that Osama bin Laden's family members, who renounced their son 10 years ago, stood to gain financially from the war being waged against him until late October, when public criticism of the relationship forced them to liquidate their holdings in the firm. Or consider that U.S. President George W. Bush is in a position to make budgetary decisions that could pad his father's bank account. But for the Carlyle Group, walking that narrow line is the art of doing business at the murky intersection of Washington politics, national security, and private capital. Mastering it has enabled the group to amass $12 billion in funds under management. Perhaps even, this is another part of the article that I really want you guys to hear. Perhaps even more disconcerting than Carlyle's ties to the Pentagon are its connections with the White House itself. Aside from signing up George Bush Sr. shortly after his presidential term ended, Carlyle gave George W. Bush a job on the board of Texas-based airline food caterer Cater Air International back in 1991. It was a subsidiary of the Carlyle Group. So Bush was an employee of it. It's the 11th largest defense contractor in the United States. And yet no one has heard of the Carlyle Group in the world of defense. It's the 11th largest defense contractor. And they own a company called United Defense. And it makes this thing called a Crusader, which is this 42-ton self-propelled howitzer that moves and operates much like a tank and can lob 155-millimeter shells per minute as far as 40 kilometers. The Crusader has been in the sights of Pentagon budget cutters since the Clinton administration, which argued that it was a relic of the Cold War era, too heavy and slow for today's warfare. Even the Pentagon had recommended the program be discontinued, but remarkably, the $11 billion contract for the Crusader is still alive thanks largely to the Carlyle Group. While it is impossible to say what U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was thinking when he made the decision to keep the Crusader program alive, people close to the situation claim to have a pretty good idea. Frank Carlucci and Donald Rumsfeld are good friends and former wrestling partners from their undergraduate days at Princeton University. So it's extraordinary. This is a company that brings families together. It brings the Bin Ladens and the Bushes together. And they were one of the war profiteers, not just in the defense industry stuff. They took their company public shortly after September 11th and made an absolute killing. Absolute killing. And these are the kinds of forces that are rising in an unprecedented manner under the Bush administration. And so in wrapping up, I mean, we can talk about the oligarchy in the Bush presidency. We can talk about the Carlyle Group. We can talk about how the Bush administration blocked the investigation of Al-Qaeda in the interest of running this oil pipeline. But just talking about all of these things and just having information and researching on the web, all of us know that that's not enough. All of us know deep somewhere in our heart that we need to resist at this time. And I say again, when high school students are being suspended from their school for wearing shirts in protest of the bombing, when people are being snitched on at their club where they work out for wearing I Don't Like War t-shirts, when thousands of people are being detained in this country and we sit silent, we're responsible. And whether we're journalists or we're doctors or we're teachers or we don't have work at the present time, somewhere in all of our day we can find a way to stand up and say no every single day of our lives. There are two other things that I want to say, and then I'm going to stop, and hopefully we can have a discussion. One really interesting fact, I don't know much about Somalia, haven't followed it all that much, was sort of spurred to do a little bit of research by the recent events and the fact that Somalia is being talked about as the next target, and the fact that this wonderful movie, Black Hawk Down, is out. In Somalia in late 1992 and 93, a consortium of oil companies discovered that there are billions and billions of dollars of oil and natural gas reserves in Somalia. There's a professor from the University of California, Berkeley, who's going to be issuing a report sometime in the next couple of weeks. Her name is Claudia Carr, and it's looking at oil companies' explorations inside of Somalia. There's also a very well-fortified military base in the north of Somalia that the Russians and the Americans have fought over for decades. So those are just, you know, and that's sort of the extent to which I sort of can speak about Somalia, but it's very interesting how the oil situation pops up in everything, even, you know, Somalia. And so when you go and watch Black Hawk Down, you got to keep in mind that before this all happened, before the U.S. came in and slaughtered Somalis, and then the Army Rangers were dragged through the streets of Mogadishu, that they had just discovered billions of dollars worth of oil reserves in Somalia. And so, in closing, I want to go back and say that when we watch TV, when we read the newspaper, when we talk to people in our everyday lives who are just pumping up the Bush administration, the patriotism, the flags, you know, we're behind our president. Doesn't matter if we're a Democrat or Republican, and yes, a Green Party member. Doesn't matter any of that. We're all Americans, and we're united in this mass slaughter. Remember that it's the gun that comes from this country that is now pointed at the rest of the world. A man who was not elected president has declared war on the world. We are living in that country, and we have a responsibility to stand up, to scream out, to speak for people who have no voice, whether they're Americans in detention, or whether they're Afghanis who are being bombed, or whether they're Iraqis who live under the misery of a dictatorship and a horrific foreign policy from America. That's what America does best, is it punishes suffering people, and it targets people who are already suffering. And all of us in this room have a responsibility to stand up and say no. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Scahill speaking earlier this year in Madison, Wisconsin. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. Access to mass media has been severely limited by laws pushed through by corporate lobbies, which culminated in the greatest spectrum giveaway in history in the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Many have turned to the Internet as the only place where equal access has been available to public interest journalism. Now the media telecom conglomerates are trying to close that door to free discourse in America. Next, Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy talks about the threat to the freedom of the Internet and the battle to save it. He spoke a few weeks ago in Seattle.